Well, just in the interest of getting us going on time, I'm Mark Kaplan from the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy. And on my right is Zeke Emanuel, who I have the privilege of introducing you today.
My far right. He's way up my far right.
Zeke, I think most of you know, is the chair of the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy. But some of you don't know, he's also the vice provost for global initiatives at Penn. And he's one of the university professors, the Diane and Robert Levy University professors here as well. For those of you who don't know, he came to us, he was the founding chair in the Department of Bioethics at the NIH, and he also served as a special advisor on health policy to the director of OMB and the National Economic Council in the White House. Zeke is both a physician and a political philosopher, at least his training warrants this claim. But I think his one of the things he's very, very much keenly interested in is the topic that he's going to address us about today, about what do we do about low-value medical services, challenges around allocation, rationing, and the assessment of medical services near and dear to his heart. So thank you for doing this.
Thank you. Welcome, Zeke.
So there's a bit of a bait and switch in that I think the title under my name said something about priorities in global setting, which I could have talked about, but I thought that this is going to be a much more, this is not going to be a formal talk in that it's going to be much more interactive session to get you to think through with me what we do about certain things in the healthcare system. So anyone who thought they were coming to discuss global stuff, you can leave now. So since no one's leaving, I assume this will be just as good, or at least it's another way of wasting an hour. All right. In 2010, the U.S. spent $2.6 trillion on healthcare. This is a staggering amount of money. I use a lot of different analogies to try to communicate how big a figure this is. So one analogy is if you stack single dollar bills, crisp $1 bills, right out of the Federal Reserve on top of each other, $2.6 trillion gets you two-thirds of the way to the moon. We spend that every year, just on healthcare, nothing else. France, another way of putting this into context, although I'm not sure, is the fifth largest economy in the world, behind the United States, China, Japan, Germany, and then France. Their GDP is also $2.6 trillion. They have 66 million people. That's everything they spend is $2.6 trillion. And we spend that simply on healthcare. So this is just a phenomenal amount of money. And we could talk about the level of increase over time, however you want to do it. But the fact of the matter is, we are not going to be able to spend that and grow it every year. This past year, just announced today's yesterday, they announced that it grew, the amount we spent grew 3.9% in the last year, which way more than inflation, which has been hovering at about zero. And that actually turns out to be the lowest level in 30 years. So you can see that we're going, and by the way, a 4% increase on $2.6 trillion, it's a good hunk of change. So if you're a health policy wonk or a bioethicist, the question is what should be done about that kind of spending? There are at least three alternatives. You could increase productivity and efficiency. So there are a lot of things we do in our healthcare system that we do inefficiently. or a lot of parts of the system that are not very high in productivity that we could do more of. So for one example, it's very likely that once we put in health information technology and people adapt and reform how they deliver care around that health information technology, we're going to get a big boost in productivity, not necessarily in the physician office, but around lots of areas. Similarly, one of the most inefficient parts of the healthcare system is billing and claims. Any of you who've ever used a doctor know about this. They have to Xerox your little card. They actually hand put in the number. They, of course, make huge numbers of mistakes when they hand put in that number, mistaking that 4 for a 9 or whatever it is. The 6 looks like an 8. And then it gets kicked back, and then you need a prior approval, and on and on. It's estimated that the process claims for the health system is somewhere in the $6 per claim area. Tenths of cents is what it takes MasterCard and Visa to electronically process when you go and swipe your card. And they have much better, as a result of the electronics, they have much better fraud control. So you also save not just in the processing of the bill, but you save in the reducing fraud, another element of productivity and efficiency. Anyway, there are lots of things we can do to increase the productivity and efficiency of the healthcare system, which would reduce what we're spending. Another thing we could do, which wouldn't necessarily reduce spending, but would certainly make the healthcare system better, is to increase high-value interventions. There are a lot of things that we know work very efficiently that we are not delivering that well. And a lot of people who are eligible for them don't get the needed care. Just take one example. It is estimated that among the Medicare population, roughly one-third of people who have high blood pressure don't even know it. And we know that this is probably the single biggest intervention. Well, we know that in the last 40 years, or 50 years, since 1960, the single biggest intervention in terms of improving longevity in America was not reducing smoking, but was actually getting lots of people to take diuretics, keep their blood pressure down, dramatically reduce stroke rates, as well as heart disease, and save lots of lives. You could see year after year in the mid to late 60s when this became much more common, dramatic declines in our mortality and increases in longevity. So we could increase these high-value interventions. Unlikely to save money. That's going to require spending money. But it would certainly make the American population better, and it would increase the value of what we're getting, which is some benefit over the cost. And the last thing is, and I'm not sure why the marker's here, the last thing we could do is to decrease low-value interventions. So our healthcare system has lots of low-value interventions. Those are things that don't improve healthcare, but cost a fair, or don't improve healthcare much or at all, and cost some money, and in many cases, a lot of money. And we could try to get rid of that kind of low-value intervention. So these are, you know, if you're someone like me thinking about how you might reduce the cost of the healthcare system, these are three areas you might focus on. Being ornery and problematic, I'm of course interested in decreasing low-value interventions because that means I take things away from doctors. So, so I want to focus on some of these low-value interventions. Because one of the things that happens when you talk to policymakers about decreasing low-value interventions is they say, oh, that's taking things away from Americans. That's rationing. We can't do that. I have had virtually that exact syllogism issued to me by several key congressional aides and one very high-level person determining health policy for this country. So, if you're interested in decreasing low-value interventions, one of the things you need to think about is, you know, is that really rational? Is that really taking something away? So, I'd like to go through with you a few scenarios around this topic and see what you think about this. So the first one is one I have been concerned about for a long time, and that's Avastin in metastatic breast cancer. Some of you may have heard of this drug. How many of you have heard of this drug? Wow, a lot of people. You read the newspaper, and you actually remember what you read. That's amazing. That was meant to be a joke, by the way. All right, now you can laugh. I give you permission. So, just to recount for you, so maybe you heard about the Avastin. In 2008, Avastin received accelerated FDA approval for the use in the treatment of patients with metastatic breast cancer. It had already been approved for treatment of women with, not women, of people with metastatic colorectal cancer. But then it got extended on the basis of a randomized trial to women with metastatic breast cancer. That decision was based upon a study that showed that Avastin slowed the progression of disease. So that meant that you didn't see the tumor grow as fast as the women who didn't get Avastin, but it didn't increase the quality of life. So when you measure quality of life, the women on Avastin did not report that they had a better quality of life, and it did not increase the length of survival of those women. So while the tumor didn't grow as fast, they still died at the same rate. It's difficult for most people to understand, well, how can that be if the tumor's not growing? How? Might have to do with the fact that tumor growth and death are not exactly one-to-one related. But in any case, given the fact that it slowed that progression of disease, the FDA decided to approve it, but required some additional tests. Additional studies were done, and last year published, and they show that Avastin doesn't improve the quality of life and doesn't improve overall survival, and yet had some significant side effects. It is true that a few women who, so far, we can't identify, we don't have a marker that says this woman will benefit and that won't, but there are a few women who do seem to significantly benefit from Avastin and get prolonged survivals. But again, given 100 women with metastatic breast cancer, no one in the world can tell you who they are by any test that we know today. So on the basis of that study, in November last year, just 2 months ago, the FDA revoked Avastin's approval for breast cancer and said it's not an indication that you can't market for breast cancer. For those of you who are curious, the cost for the average treatment cycle for women with metastatic breast cancer is about $88,000 per patient, not chump change. So Medicare, almost immediately, actually slightly before the FDA made its announcement, said it's going to continue to pay for Avastin for metastatic breast cancer. Blue Shield of California and Kaiser announced that they're not going to continue to pay for Avastin, and I think as of October, Blue Shield said it's not, it's no longer paying. Now, why do you think Medicare said it's going to continue to pay for breast cancer for Avastin? It's not FDA approved.
It's an election year.
Huh?
It's an election year.
That's part of it. But it was 2011, not exactly 2012. But yes, we're getting to
every year is an election year.
Right, we're getting into the silly season, and there's one other closely related. What? Yeah, there are a lot of advocates, and they made it. There was a big mistake. Some of you may remember in September 2009, in the heat of healthcare reform debates in this country. The United States Preventive Services Task Force issued its report about mammograms, saying shouldn't do mammograms on women under 50, which of course provoked a whole controversy about women and breast cancer and all this. So it was a complete lightning rod. But a large part of this is Medicare did not want to be accused of rationing cancer care to women. And here's why. As I say here, decisions about what to pay for, especially decisions that stop payment for a drug or procedures, elicit the charge of rationing. And if you think we're making this up, here's the good Senator David Bitter of Louisiana. The fact remains that thousands of women today depend on Avastin as a vital tool in the fight against breast cancer, and the FDA should not have taken that option off the table by rationing access. Okay? Got the word. Took no time at all. It's amazing how senators can think this. So, here's the question for you. Get your clickers ready. I mean your hands. So, is a decision by Blue Shield of California and Kaiser not to pay for Avastin rationing? Yes. Raise your hands. I got like three or four people. Those people who think no, raise your hands. And don't be shocked. Someone voting twice over here? This isn't Chicago. This is Philadelphia. Those people who are undecided, raise your hands. Small minority of undecided. All right. But whatever it shows, at least in this crowd, well-educated, overly white, this isn't rationing. Most people do not think this is rationing. And it's not like by a small number here. Two-thirds, three-quarters of you, probably by my eyeball. But this, of course, raises the philosophical question of what is rationing? I am not going to answer this question. I am simply going to give you a little chart conceptually to think about the different categories, and we're going to come back to this chart. So, in one case, you have high cost and no benefit over standard treatment. If an insurance company or Medicare refuses to pay, is that rationing? If they charge extra, would that be rationing? Second category is you have higher cost, so something adds tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars, but you might have no survival benefit, but you might have a serious convenience benefit. You can take it once a day. You may have to go to the doctor only once instead of repeatedly. Third category, you can have higher cost and a small additional survival benefit, so something that costs a lot of money. And we're going to get to each one of these cases. I'm just laying it out for you as to understand the thinking behind the next set of challenges. And then you can have something that has higher costs and large additional survival or other benefits. So let's switch to my second favorite example, proton beam therapy for metastatic prostate cancer. Some of you may have read my op-ed last week. If you haven't, no harm done. That also was a joke. Proton beam therapy is a type of radiation used to treat cancer. It differs from usual radiation. Usual radiation is X-rays, and proton beams shoots particles, basically nuclei of hydrogen atoms, for those two chemistry majors in the audience. Generating a proton requires a particle accelerator, which has to be encased in a football-sized building with a lot of cement and lead. Those of you who are unfamiliar with these buildings, just go over to the parking garage and the Roberts Proton Beam Facility, and you can see it's at the bottom of the garage, and the whole garage there is protecting you from stray protons. That's not true. But there is a lot of cement there that is protecting you from stray protons. The reason that people are interested in protons as a radiation therapy is that they can be focused more precisely on where the cancer is, minimizing damage, at least in theory, to surrounding healthy tissue, because you can get them to, as it were, stop moving right where the cancer is. So proton beam therapy has been demonstrated to be the best approach for a select group of cancers, that is pediatric brain and spinal cord cancers. They're tumors on the surface. And the main reason is that they decrease the side effects associated with radiation for these diseases. You've got kids, they've got developing brains which are growing, making new connections. So they get, if you use regular radiation, they get sclerosis and they get mental retardation, decrease in IQ. They also can, depending on where the tumor is, get hearing loss and a few other serious side effects. When you use proton beam, the chance of those side effects dramatically drops. The good news is we don't have a whole lot of pediatric brain cancer. We don't have a whole lot of pediatric cancer to begin with, but we don't have a whole lot of pediatric brain cancer in this country. There are about 3,000 cases of brain and spinal cord cancers per year in the United States. So it's not a big epidemic, and it's not a major public health problem, So you have proton beams for a small number of cases. Now, it's simply impossible to pay for the proton beam therapy facilities on just 3,000 patients a year. The Penn proton beam facility costs about $100 million to build, a big expense. You can't, on just a few thousand patients, pay those kind of capital costs for a large number of facilities. The consequence is doctors who like proton beams are hunting around for other people who they can put into the machines and zap. And the leading list is a bunch of cancers. Lung cancer, breast cancer has been tried, esophageal cancer has been tried. The number one item, however, is prostate cancer patients, because who gets prostate cancer?
Older.
Not just older men. And what do we know about older men?
They go to Congress.
They're rich. And they are congressmen, by the way. Yes,
right.
And so this has not escaped the notice of, and there are a lot of them. There are prostate cancer in this country is diagnosed about 250,000 men a year. Currently, just to give you the state, there are 9 proton beam facilities in the United States today, including one right here in Philadelphia, probably, I don't know, half a mile from here, maybe a little less. But there are 20 in various stages of planning and development. Now, obviously, raising $100+ million to build one of these things is not easy. There are probably 20 where there have been, you know, press releases, we're building. Some of those have money and are really breaking grounds. There's one in northern New Jersey, which is going to open in April in Somerset. Some of them are simply paper tigers, people making an announcement hoping to get financing. But, you know, there are people who are out there trying to make some serious moves on this. Mayo Clinic announced last year in the spring of 2011 that it's going to build not one, but 2 machines. You know, has to compete with UPenn and MGH. So it wants 2 machines, one in Rochester, Minnesota, one in Scottsdale, Arizona, and each is going to cost over $180 million. And in, I think, December, they just broke ground in Scottsdale to begin building. They got the money, $100 million donation from a nice guy in the farm equipment or farm storage or farm implement business from Iowa, Mr. Jacobs. And if you'd like to see, they have actually a video on YouTube of the announcement with him sitting there shaking his head while the president of Mayo is announcing this. Now, in the prostate cancer area, proton beam therapy has not been directly compared to standard treatments for prostate cancer. There has never been a head-to-head comparison. There are a bunch of small studies, single institution, that says, you know, we can deliver this treatment, we can zap the cancer, but there's never been a comparative study. There is no data showing that proton beam is better or even equal to standard radiation, surgery for early stage prostate cancer, or simply observing people with none of the side effects. Currently, Medicare pays $59,000 for proton beam therapy, and the standard treatment, which is called IMRT, pays about $26,000 for the standard radiation treatment. So, 2-to-1, twice as expensive, an added $30,000 for the privilege of sitting in the proton beam facility. So, the first question for you folks is, do you agree or disagree with Medicare's decision to pay for proton beam therapy for prostate cancer? Those of you who agree, please raise your hand. No one? Where's our white men? There are 2 people who agree that we should pay.
With your facts.
Okay. My facts are the facts. Do you disagree? All I've done is taken the actual data. How many people disagree with Medicare's decision to pay for this at 53? How many people don't know? Don't want to make the policy choice. So more don't know than agree, but the majority, I think, disagreed, 50, 60%. What, you're a late voter?
Is it ethical to use if it's not been shown? Yeah. Is it ethical to use if it's not been shown to be as good as the standard treatment, right, from a medical point of view?
In theory, it's better. What do I know? If Medicare didn't pay for proton beam therapy for prostate cancer, that would be rationing. How many people agree that would be rationing if they didn't pay for proton beam? 1, 2, 3, 4. Four people. How many think it wouldn't be rationing if they didn't pay? Hold your hand up. I can't see. I'm trying to figure out if this is a majority. It looks like a majority. How many people don't know? What is with the don't knows here? This is you. Taking the don't know off the slides.
We're struggling over the
definition. So it looks like.
We don't have a definition of
rationing. When I go to a congressperson, they don't say, what's the definition of rationing? They say, it is rationing. I'm asking you what you think. Is it rationing or is it not rationing?
It's rationing.
All right. Now we're about to move on. Since my favorite group, of which I am now a member of the cohort, are older white men, Art and I are the leading examples. I'm going to continue on the prostate cancer bandwagon. We're going to move, however, from the early stage prostate cancer to metastatic prostate cancer. So, Provenge is a treatment for men who have developed metastatic prostate cancer. Now, metastatic prostate cancer means that the prostate cancer has spread beyond the prostate and is no longer curable. You will have prostate cancer as long as you live. You may not die from prostate cancer, you may die with it, but you will not get rid of the prostate cancer. Now, compared to placebo, Provenge extends the life of men with metastatic prostate cancer by 4 months. With placebo, they live 21 months. With Provenge, they live 25 months. Denderon, which is the company that made Provenge, priced it at $93,000 per patient for treatment. It says the price reflects its official announcement, where it explained this price, said it reflects the more than $1 billion it spent on research, development, and going to the FDA. Medicare decided to pay for Provenge at $93,000 per patient. Question for you. Do you agree or disagree with Medicare's decision to pay for Provenge? Those of you who agree, please raise your hand. One, two, three. We got about 10. Those of you who disagree, please raise your hands. Got about probably a majority. Those people who don't know.
It's the don't know.
What are the side effects?
Okay.
What's the quality of life?
Good quality of life. No side effects to this thing. All right. If Medicare did not pay for Provenge, that would constitute rationing. Do you agree with that statement? Raise your hand. Again, about, oh, here we might about 12 or 13. Disagree. That would not define, be rationing. Raise your hands. Less. Interestingly, even less than proton beam. Those who are uncertain. Sprinkling.
But what would be the rationale?
Probably.
I mean, what was all the reasoning?
All right, hold on. If Medicare did not pay for Provenge, but some people, rich white guys, decided to pay for it out of their pocket, that would be unfair and unjust. Who agrees that would be unfair and unjust? If some men could pay for it out of their own pocket, but not everyone could get it, raise your hands. That would be unfair. No one. It's not unfair. Okay, those who disagree, who think it would be, who don't think it would be unfair. Okay, those who are unsure. Wow. Okay, so people are all right with that. Okay, I think we have two more cases here. Etcetera's for Hodgkin's lymphoma. Hodgkin's disease is not also a ravaging public health menace. It is about 5,000 cases per year. This new drug is a treatment for Hodgkin's lymphoma, but a particular kind. Usually Hodgkin's is at least potentially curable. Some people have a very resistant, chemo-resistant type of Hodgkin's disease, and they're called refractory. They don't respond to the drugs, it doesn't shrink. Some people, they respond to the drugs, but it grows back. And you give them different drugs, it still grows back, so it's the same kind of resistance. So the people where it doesn't respond, they're refractory, and the people where it grows back, they're multiply relapsed patients. So Etcetera is this drug that's targeted to a situation where the patients do not otherwise respond to chemotherapy. There is no other effective treatment for these patients who have refractory or multiply relapsed Hodgkin's lymphoma, and they will die of the disease because there's nothing we have that will fight it except now Etcetera. Research has shown that Etcetera shrinks the cancer for most patients with recurrent or relapsed Hodgkin's lymphoma. In 32, a third of the cases, the patients have a complete response. That is, on X-ray or MRI scan, you got a tumor, you give them Etcetera, and the tumor disappears. Can't see it on the MRI anymore. Now, that doesn't mean every last cell of the Hodgkin's disease has gone away. It still might come back. It does mean, however, that you have gotten rid of all visible signs of the tumor. In 40% of the patients, you don't get the tumor completely to shrink, but you get it to shrink by more than 50%. So you have a substantial response, as we say in my business. The median length of response, that is, more than half the patients, the tumor stays shrunk, does not grow back for 9.7, 10 months. And for the other half, it's less than 10 months. The FDA approved Etcetera. The company announced it intends to charge about $100,000 for a typical course of treatment. I think that was 8 cycles, if I'm not mistaken, of treatment. But for some patients, they might keep going with the treatment. It could cost over $200,000 for treatment. Medicare has not yet issued a decision. As of like 3 weeks ago, we called the chief medical officer at Medicare, and he said, it's not even on my docket. So I'm safe to say they haven't made a decision. So do you agree? Now you're sitting in the hot seat. You're the chief medical officer of Medicare. You're going to have to make a decision. Do you pay for it or not pay for it? Do you agree or disagree that Medicare should pay for Etcetera? How many people think Medicare should pay for Etcetera? Raise your hands. A lot of people. People are nervous. How many people disagree, thinks that we shouldn't? 1, 2, 3, 4. How many people don't know? 6 or 7, 8 people. Okay. If Medicare did not pay for Etcetera, would that be rationing? How many people think it would be rationing? Raise your hand. Okay, about half, more, about 60%. How many people don't think that would be rationing if Medicare decided not to pay? One person, two people. How many people aren't sure? 8 or 10. All right, so that's our Etcetera case. Now we've talked about Avastin, proton beam, Provenge, Etcetera, and here's, I believe, the last example. Fortunately, oncology is full of very expensive treatments. Abraxane and Taxol are two drugs. Some of you may have heard of Taxol. They're both used to treat metastatic breast cancer as well as many other diseases. Abraxane is essentially Taxol that is delivered in a nanoparticle, so it's attached here. One of the problems of Taxol is that it causes a lot of reactions. People have an allergic reaction, or many people have an allergic reaction to it. When it first came out in the early 1990s and I was administering it to patients, you'd have to give them steroids and a lot of anti-allergy medications, and they still had a lot of problems with it. So a guy in L.A. developed this Abraxane, which minimized the side effects. So compared to Taxol for metastatic breast cancer, Abraxane slows the progress of the disease, and patients respond better to it. There, however, is no difference between Abraxane and Taxol in terms of overall survival. Again, you have this slowing of the tumor, but when you look at overall survival, it doesn't make a difference. Even though Abraxane slows the progression, it doesn't extend life one day. But Abraxane is more convenient for the patient. They don't need to receive steroids before getting treatment. The infusion time, how long it takes you to deliver it, you can just burn it in, whereas Taxol, you have to give it slowly to reduce the chance of getting the allergic reaction. But there's a price difference. Abraxane costs $15,000 per week to give. Taxol is $3,500 per week. So about a four-fold price difference there. But I should say one other thing here. Again, in metastatic breast cancer, women don't get cured of metastatic breast cancer. In the case of metastatic breast cancer, women will die of the breast cancer, unless they're hit by a truck first. But in general, they will die of the breast cancer. We have no known cure for it. Some women can live a long time with metastatic breast cancer. I once had a patient who lived 12 years in the metastatic setting. That is highly unusual. Usually it's much shorter. But no one is cured of this disease. Question. If Medicare did not pay for Abraxane for metastatic breast cancer, but did pay for Taxol, that would be rationing. How many people agree with that? How many people disagree? It wouldn't be rationing if they didn't pay that extra $15,000. That's about even split, it looked like. How many people don't know? Are there consistent don't-knows here? You guys just want to opt out. If Medicare paid only $3,500 for Abraxane and required patients who wanted the Abraxane to pay the rest, so that extra $11,500, that would be rationing. Who agrees with that statement? Okay, who disagrees with that statement? More people disagree now, it looks like. So if you ask people to pay a higher copay for the more expensive drug, that doesn't seem to be rationing to hear. Who doesn't know? Who's unsure?
Selective rationing.
I've never heard of the term selective rationing. All right. So I want to go back to this chart. Now, I know a lot of you were sort of upset or worried or concerned that I didn't give you a definition of rationing. So one thing to note, that if you were economists in this room, you know, if we've gone over to Wharton and given this talk, and there was a true Wharton type, properly educated in the Wharton method, they would have raised their hand for every one of these. They're all rationing, right? Every time you decide, it's all rationing, right? Every time you sell something in the store, it's rationed. Not everyone can buy it because it's got a price tag on it. It's rationed. That obviously is not what most Americans think of rationing, right? We don't think that it's rationing because we have to pay $1.99 for a half a gallon of milk. That doesn't sound like rationing to us. So whatever the economists call rationing, that's not the common sense notion of rationing. But I don't think most of us know what the common sense notion of rationing, what the limits and parameters are. And part of this exercise, I was going to call it a game, but it's much too serious for a game. Part of this exercise is to think through, well, what do I think is rationing? And has that very negative connotation that could get a politician in trouble. And what isn't rationing, which can be restricted without the negative salience and negative political fallout. So, as I showed you before, I divided these kind of treatments into four categories. Maybe you could think of more. There are these high-cost, no-benefit treatments over standard care. There are two that we discussed that fall into that category. High cost and no benefit. Proton beam, no benefit, but higher cost. And Avastin, high cost and no proven benefit. So I think most of you said, correct me if I'm wrong, if I misremembered, if insurance or Medicare refused to pay for those, most of you thought that would not constitute rationing.
I thought you said there was no evidence about whether there was a benefit.
No evidence is no benefit.
No evidence is no evidence.
So you think there's benefit? It's just metaphysical concept? There's benefit, but we can't prove it?
No, I'm saying that unless...
All right, so it's... Okay. All right, so we could divide this into two. There's high cost, no proven benefit, right, and high cost, no benefit with proof. Okay? Now, maybe you want to differentiate those two in the payment realm, and you would like to say Let's talk about the Avastin case simpler, and then we can talk about the proton beam. So I think for most people in the Avastin case, but not all, not everyone in the room, it was not rationing. We would X this box. Not rationing in the Avastin case was not proven beneficial. Yet Medicare decided to pay for it, and it ain't a cheap drug. It's a classic. It's not even a low-value drug. It's a no-value drug in my nomenclature because there's no proven benefit. Now, some of you, at least one of you, says high cost, no proven benefit, but unknown benefit is a little different. And is that rationing if you restrict no proven benefit? You want to argue it one way or another there?
No, I want to say I want to find out.
Of course I want to find out, but you got to make a coverage decision before you got data.
In the case of Avastin, I
have data. Wait a sec. Coverage decision of proton beam before I have data. If they said no, would that be rationing?
A number of countries can.
Wait, just hold on. Did I call on you?
In a classic sense, yes.
I already said in a classic sense, we're not in a classic sense. In a classic sense, they're all rationing. But no, people did not vote as economists. We all already learned many years ago that the economist's view of rationality is not the way most people work. So I am not here. I thought I implied that. Let me straighten it out again, all right? If I gave a lecture to dyed-in-the-wool, Wharton-trained people, they would have no trouble. All of these are rationing. They don't think there's an issue with it. Question is it legitimate rationing or not? So I would say, legitimate rationing, yes or no? That's all you end up doing. It's not more. The question is, the average common sense person is, we take away the word legitimate, and we say, if it's legitimate rationing, we call it no rationing, and if it's not legitimate rationing, we call it rationing. The question I ask you is, if I put in no proven benefit, and I make a decision without the data, of course we all like the data, but we don't have the data, and we're not going to have the data for another 10 years. Would it be rationing in your book?
Yes.
If Medicare refused? Yes. So you're yes. Most people, I think it's a no. I know it's a no because I asked the question and most people said no. So the question is, what about charges extra? Well, if you think refused is not rationing, charges extra is hardly likely to be rationing in this case, right? What about the case of higher cost added convenience? That's the Abraxane Taxol case. No added survival benefit. There is, however, a benefit. No steroids, faster infusion, you get in and out, and the cost is about four times as much. No survival benefit. Is it rationing if Medicare refuses to pay? Most of you thought that was rationing. But you thought, so you didn't like the fact if Medicare said, we're not covering Abraxane, we're just going to go with the cheaper drug, they do the same thing as far as the endpoint, we really care about survival. Most of you said that's not good. They should allow people to get it for an extra charge, and that would not be rationing. That extra charge. Okay? It's in this box. Just be clear, I would venture to say, I don't know the incomes, I have not done the wallet biopsy of everyone in this room. I think most of us, speaking for myself, would not be able to afford $11,500 per week for very long. So it's going to restrict it to a very small number of people getting Abraxane. Higher cost, small additional survival benefit. This is the Provenge case. This is the classic, in my humble opinion, low-value treatment. You get four extra months on average, and you pay in $93,000 for four extra months. It's not that it's no benefit. There's a benefit. On average, 4 months. But it's also a lot of money. Just out of curiosity, imagine you're a 70-year-old white man with metastatic prostate cancer. How many people, out of their own pocket, would pay $93,000 for that treatment?
Oh.
You would. Two, three, okay, four. So there are a handful of you. How many would not pay that if you were the majority? Now assume you're same 70-year-old man with metastatic prostate cancer. How many of you
would want Medicare. If Medicare were paying for it, you would take it.
Yeah.
How many of you? I just want to know. I like hypocrisy. It's okay. We wouldn't pay for it, but if our neighbor's paying for us, that's A-okay, man. All right. This is the classic low value, and most of you said that if Medicare refused to pay, I think most of you said, that would not be rationing. So this is a very important category. The higher cost, large additional survival benefit, that's the Ascentris case, where you have a disease that responds to nothing else. There is simply no other treatment, and it's a miracle drug in most oncologists' view. You got something which is resistant to all the drugs we know we can throw at it, and you got this drug, and in a third of cases, the tumor simply goes away. And for more than half the population, they're living more than 10 months where they're otherwise their survival would be just a few weeks or months. Most of you thought that if we restricted that, and that drug costs $100,000 and could be $200,000, so it's the same price range as everything else, that you thought would be rationing. Okay? In my view, not any individual here, since many of you are undecided, but as a group, you seem to say the following. You refuse to pay no value, that is, no benefit, high cost treatments. Convenience doesn't really sing to you too much. This, the low value case, you shouldn't, it is not rationing if Medicare refuses. But in the case where there's a home run, big benefits, high value, that is rationing. And I personally think, hope to prove, that that's exactly what the American public, and I'm going to go out on a very strong limb, that's even what cancer patients think is rationing. You got something, I don't care if it costs $100,000 or $200,000, it really makes a big difference. You prevent me from getting it, that's rationing. On the other hand, it does a little couple of months and you're charging me $93,000. That's not worth it, and restricting it is not going to be considered rationing. That is a very different view of the world, I think, certainly than Washington has, and certainly than we've been allowed to have. So we are in the process of surveying. We're at the start. We are about to begin a survey of oncologists, cancer patients, and the public around this. And my hypothesis is that they will respond as a group the way you have responded as a group. And I would say that I have not done this. I think this is the fourth time I've done this. And every group amazingly responds the same. So now we can have questions.
Well, first of all, you conflated rationing with refuse to pay.
I viewed
all as rationing because I'm too close to economists. But
I'm sorry.
I saw that. Be that as, you know, despite my defects, it's all rationing, and I think some rationing makes more sense.
So I would I could just put in the word legitimate if that makes you feel better and sleep better, but it doesn't change the essence of the debate.
Well,
yeah.
You probably benefit mostly by survival.
No, I have one here, which is convenience.
I know you had convenience, but I'm thinking of a different type of benefit. I'm thinking of a quality of life benefit. If you guys have prostate patients, and you tell them about the risk of, let's say, incontinence and impotence from retinal radiation, and if that targeted beam radiation reduces that significantly, would you not get
a... My grandmother used to have a statement, you know... If I had a penis, I'd be your grandfather. I agree with you. If there was a benefit, there'd be a benefit. I didn't say the only benefit is survival. I made it easy for you, focusing on survival. But you're right. If it reduced, say, diarrhea or impotence 50%, then we got a benefit. It's not the only benefit. Survival's not the only benefit. There are other side effects. I didn't
Did we not have data on the proton beam?
Let me repeat. There are no comparative data. Zero. I am not exaggerating. When I said I reported all the data, I reported all the data. Zero.
But if you don't pay for it, you're never going to get the data because nobody's going to do it.
Yeah?
So would it, in terms of there is data that it is helpful for pediatric
brain cancer.
Brain cancer.
Right.
So would it be possible to sustain even one facility with that number of cases for pediatric cancers, or is that a benefit of using it for other cases as well?
That's a very good question, which is how many facilities could you sustain with 3,000 patients? And by the way, if you know, even if you had 5, 6, 7 facilities, right now we have 9 operating. Say we froze it at 9, they'd have many more slots than pediatric brain cancers to keep operating. But say you had the right number for pediatric brain cancers, I think the British did this, and I think it's 1 per 5 million is what you need for half the slots to be pediatric and half the slots to be other stuff where you're investigating, using it for research. I think it's 1 for 5 million. No, it can't be 1 for 5 million, because that means we would need way too many.
Yeah.
So it must be something like, I think Britain might be 1 for 20 million, something in that range. In any case, we're right close to that number. And so you could sustain maybe around 10 of them if half the patients going in were pediatric and half were other things, mostly where you're trying to do it experimentally to see if it makes a big difference. The problem in the United States is you cannot support, certainly even the 9 we've got mostly aren't pediatric brain cancers, and you certainly can't support 20 more on that basis. Yeah.
Just 2 short comments. There are already systems, and they should be used for paying when there's a lack of evidence under trial circumstances, so that you are paying and learning and gathering systematic data. And the second comment is that the whole kind of discussion takes for granted the prices given by the companies based on unproven R&D costs, which what evidence we have show that their net median costs are really very much lower.
So
other companies negotiate lower prices.
I'm not, in the case of Provenge, the $1 billion is probably not far off of what they actually paid, because they actually had to go back to the FDA 5 separate times to finally get it approved. It was not a slam dunk. It skidded through by the skin of its teeth. It had been rejected before. In that case, I do think $1 billion is not an exaggerated claim. And even if it was $800 million or $750 million, you know, I don't think that substantially affects the ethical reasoning. I would say there are what are called coverage with evidence development that you have to go into a trial. Medicare has been loath to use those mechanisms. I think they're perfectly legitimate. I actually don't think it's the best mechanism, best design. I mean, we've proposed dynamic pricing as a better mechanism. Yeah?
I was just going to mention, I think a lot of Americans would kind of scoff at the idea of paying a lot of money for extra convenience. No one's going to pay $20,000 for a key fob to their car. They're going to use a key. But in theory, I don't know how that trial was structured, but convenience can have other benefits, like people actually taking the drug.
You got metastatic breast cancer. We typically don't have that problem.
I would hope so, but I don't know how that trial was structured and how closely they followed up with whether the people were taking it.
It turns out in cancer trials, that's not a real big problem.
Mm-hmm. Isn't it more than just taking it? It could be the fact that you become productive members of society.
So let me tell you a story about the great claim about productive members of society through to another life-saving treatment. Dialysis was a new treatment in the 1960s, chronic dialysis, because in the early 60s they found a way around the problem, which was they ended up shooting all the veins. So they needed a fistula, which they put in between an artery and a vein, where they could repeatedly stick in the needle. They could then dialyze people who were had chronic renal failure and do it three times a week and make them productive members of society instead of allowing them to die. And it was very expensive, three times a week, a very expensive treatment, they're requiring 3 hours. There was, insurance wouldn't pay for it. Congress held hearings on it, and they wheeled in a guy getting dialysis right in front of Congress at a congressional hearing, and they made dialysis part of Medicare. We socialized medical care for dialysis. It's the only thing we have socialized medicine for other than vets. So, we covered it, and the main justification for covering it is we'll return these people to be productive members of society. I don't want to disparage people with chronic renal failure or dialysis. My father was a dialysis doctor for kids. I just urge you to go to the nearest DaVita dialysis place and see how many of those people are productive members of society. The fact of the matter is, most of them don't return to being productive members of society, go on and earn incomes, etc. In point of fact, what you end up with once you make it an entitlement and you begin to pay for these things is everybody who has chronic renal failure, whether they're going back to a job, they're 78 years old, have 27 other illnesses, including heart disease, diabetes, blindness, gets dialysis, and they're not very necessarily productive members of society. That doesn't mean you shouldn't pay for it. I'm not saying you shouldn't pay for it, but the idea that we pay for it and they will become productive members of society, in general, skepticism is in order. So, Art.
So, two things. I think the boxes are useful to explore ordinary understanding of rationing. I'm a little nervous about convenience being equated, as David Hoke started to say, with allergy or allergic response or having to take steroids. One might say, let's shift from convenience and mode of administration over to, you know, miserably itchy every day. You want to pay for that, you don't want to pay for that. And on survival benefit, I like survival benefit, but if I had a pill that kept Terry Schiavo alive twice as long, that's like $3,000, nobody wants to pay for that either. So, there's some...
Well, one of the advantages of using oncology cases is we don't have to get into Terry Schiavo's mental state.
But nonetheless, survival benefit here is, I think people have in mind, big benefit, pretty normal lifestyle.
Yeah.
As it slides down into your dialysis example or other things, weaker. So you've got to make it explicit. Otherwise, you don't want to overweight the value that people put in thinking about what to ration on survival benefit, raw survival. I think that there's risk there, is my caution.
Using the examples helps eliminate that problem.
Just to kind of mess with you a bit, consider a project that my company's working on with CMS, which is basically understanding that in public policy, rationing is a third rail. So how do you have a discussion about rationing that makes at least some of this a little less arguable? So what we're working on is treatments that Medicare currently pays for, actually Medicaid, that Medicaid currently pays for, that there is actually demand for, but actually cause harm and actually incur costs. Two examples that we're working on are elective preterm deliveries, and another is central line infections, especially in the pediatrics population. Those are both events that can be eliminated, but still occur, and Medicaid pays for them. So that's kind of one thing to mess with you.
So I don't think that messes with me at all. Okay, let's just add a box here. High cost, negative benefit, right? Harm. You know, I think if I've got people saying this isn't rationing, who's going to say that is rationing? I mean, I think that's such an easy example. I don't think it's of interest. And it's also, from my standpoint, not that much interest from a health policy standpoint, because whatever our use of it is, it's just not a big chunk of $2.6 trillion.
Well, actually, in the state of Ohio, it saved in 1 year over $100 million eliminating...
Let me let you in on a secret. When you're a health policy guy, $100 million, irrelevant. $1 billion, also irrelevant. When we get to $10 billion, we start getting relevant. It's just the nature of the world when you talk about $2.6 trillion. So, anyone over here? No?
Yeah. Instead of using the word rationing, which makes everybody a little bit crazy because we don't know what
but
it means.
That's what it is, the game is.
That's the game?
That's the Washington game. If you want to influence policymakers, finding another word that is really cool but isn't the word used in public, it's not relevant.
Because to answer these questions, if the question was, is this good, logical use of our resources, they're easy questions to answer. When you use the word rationing, part of our thought process is not...
I did ask you that question. I said, do you agree or disagree with the Medicare decision to pay for it? I didn't say anything. That was even before I asked you a rationing question. Right?
Correct.
Yeah. So I didn't ask good medical use of resources. I just asked, if you were at CMS, would you pay for it? And the answer was?
Yes, in some of them.
I think in most of the cases you did say yes, but you were in the minority. So, yeah.
I'm wondering if that bottom row there, where I think Medicare or insurance pays some of it and
charges the marginal cost, as they say in economics.
So you were assuming that the company would charge the same price.
I meant to actually say something about that. Yes. So let me just back up. One of the reasons that you will notice that I mostly use the Medicare example, because Medicare has no ability, by law, to negotiate prices. Company says $93,000, Medicare cannot say, all right, I'll give you 20, and then we settle at 50 or whatever it is. Medicare cannot do that. Medicare has to accept the price dictated by the company.
So your example is hypothetical, assuming the laws change, or assuming Medicare
could
just set the price.
Oh, on the one with convenience, yeah. Where I said if they would, well, insurance companies can do that, correct.
So then basically we're creating marketplace rationing, where the company can negotiate.
Yeah. But notice when I did this example, and I talked about the higher cost and added convenience, and said, well, if the company did that, and people were required to pay the $11,500 extra, most people didn't find that objectionable. They didn't think that was rationing. They thought that was perfectly fair, I think was the word in there, unfair. So, I mean, I think for most people, it turns out that when there's not a survival benefit, and you got a case of, you know, a potential allergy, or you require steroid pre-medication and a slower infusion rate, so you have to be there longer. Most people find that with the same survival, not a problem if that's everyone gets that, and a few rich people can afford the $11,000 and buy up.
Right, but aside from the convenience, there's an issue of just the marketplace doing the rationing, or is the government or insurance company?
Right. At the moment, I'm not right. I mean, we are in America. Most people worry more about the government than they do about the marketplace. And so I think they feel much more comfortable in the marketplace ration.
Got time for two more questions.
Great, we've got two more questions.
So Medicare can't negotiate with the drug companies, but they can call it the slice, right?
Well, no, so typically what they do, typically in these cases, again, that's set by law. They pay oncologists $93,000 for the drug at a 6% administration fee. No negotiation. That is set by law. They couldn't pay them 4% unless Congress changed the law. They can't pay them 8% unless Congress changes the law. So that's set. Charles, you had...
No, it seems to me that the problem is the law, not the rationing. That Medicare can't negotiate... seems to me to be...
Your chance of changing the law even lower than my chance of changing American public opinion. So that's where we stand. Thank you very much. And, we have a reception or something?
Yeah, next door.
I'm not going to do it.
McCarthy. I think once you show that a lot of Americans don't find that rational, it's very hard to wear that's not rational. That's okay to do. It's not a direct line from there. I do think it emboldens people when they begin saying things. No, I never read those things.